When we left off, journalist Jane Mayer was explaining the secret American policy of extraordinary rendition, which allows for terrorism suspects to be deported to countries where they are imprisoned, interrogated, and in some cases tortured. And she told us the story of my guest, Maher Arar. He's a citizen of Canada and Syria who was deported by American authorities to Syria, where he was beaten, interrogated, and kept in a tomb-like cell for over 10 months. Arar was released in October 2003 and returned to Canada. 3 years later, a Canadian commission cleared him of all terrorism allegations. Arar is a wireless engineer who is now studying for his doctorate. Meher, let's start with your story. You were at JFK Airport on your way from Tunis to Canada, and this was just an airport stopover. You'd been vacationing with your family. How were you told that you were being detained?
Well, I presented my passport at immigration. To my surprise, I had to go through immigration. It was just transit, and I had traveled extensively before to the States, and none of this really happened. They asked me to go into a waiting area, and eventually some airport police and New York police and FBI people showed up, and they asked me whether I was willing to give them an interview. And I found that very puzzling, as they did not really tell me ahead of time what it was about. And my immediate reaction was to be able to make a phone call, to call my family. And I also asked them to be able to have a lawyer present. And they told me that I had no right to a lawyer, because I was not an American citizen, and that was a shock to me.
What kinds of questions did they ask you?
Well, as usual, the questions started, with the routine questions, but eventually they asked me about people I knew in Ottawa. We now know that those people were having some suspicions about some of these people as a result of a Canadian investigation. But from the nature of the questioning and the information they had, in fact, they had a thick report in their hands that they were consulting from time to time. The nature of the questioning and the information they had made it clear to me that they had private information that could only come from Canada.
Jane Mayer in The Dark Side writes that although you didn't know it at the time, you were falsely implicated when two men were tortured in Syria and under torture just offered up your name.
Today we have a lot more information than we had before on the public record, and so we kind of know more about the story. But at that time, you have to remember, I was in the dark about what was going on. And do we really know the full story yet? I don't think so. I think there's so many other pieces of the puzzle that we still have to find. But you're quite right. Apparently, those two people they were asking me about, at that time, they were both detained by the Syrian military intelligence, apparently as a result of information sent from both the Americans and the Canadian police. And under torture, one of them had confessed to a false plot against the U.S. Embassy in Ottawa, but it does not seem that he implicated me in whether directly or indirectly in that plot. But the Syrian military intelligence, who was at that time trying to prove to the West and especially United States that they were doing their fair share of the war on terror, they actually had to just find something on so that they would please the Americans. So they had to ask, about other people, and eventually, according to the public information we have, he confessed to have seen me in Afghanistan, and I don't think I was alone. He probably named many other people. So maybe that was in the hands of the Americans, where they were asking me. We really don't know all the facts. But the O'Connor inquiry clearly stated...
This is the Canadian inquiry into your case.
The Canadian inquiry, it took about 2.5 years of public investigation. I just want to clarify this because it's an important point. The commissioner of the inquiry clearly stated in his report that my problems all started with the Canadian police, which we call here the RCMP, which is the equivalent of the FBI. They sent false information to their counterparts, and that led to all my problems. Now, whether the Americans had information from Syria or not, we don't know the facts, but obviously the commissioner concluded that I was sent to Syria very likely based on this false information sent by the RCMP to the FBI. And just to give you an example of what this kind of information was, one report described myself and my wife as Islamic extremists with possible links to Al-Qaeda. And during the inquiry, the RCMP officers admitted that they had no evidence whatsoever to use those labels. So, and they never corrected their record with the Americans. So I just want to be, you know, give a clear picture about what kind of information the FBI had in their possession before I was stopped there.
Meher, you were held for 13 days in the United States. Then you were put on a plane. You were told you were being taken to Syria. What went through your mind when you heard that you were being taken to Syria?
First of all, I was shocked that a country like the United States, that always prided itself with protecting human rights and condemning torture and that they would send me to there despite my fears, despite the fears I expressed to them that I would be tortured. That was my initial reaction. And then when I realized I was actually going to go there, I did not want to believe I was being sent to Syria because of all the memories I had from my childhood when my parents told me about how people are tortured there, especially political detainees and people accused of being members of Islamic groups. And then when I was on the plane, all the time, I was very worried about what was going to happen next. Basically, I became convinced by that time that the Americans sent me there to be tortured. There was no other explanation for me. So during the entire trip, I was preoccupied about how I could avoid torture. That was my main, worry. Once I'm in Syria, how I avoid to be tortured.
So when you got to Syria, you were taken to a prison that's apparently very notorious, that's nicknamed the Grave. And Jane Mayer describes it as the heart of the Syrian intelligence service's dungeon-like interrogation center. What was your cell like in this Syrian prison?
My cell was about 3 feet wide, about 6 feet deep, and about 7 feet high. Frankly, when they opened the door for me and they asked me to go in, I naively thought that I would be put in there for a day or two just to put pressure on me. But that cell ended up being my home for the next 10 months and 10 days. This cell, as filthy as it was, as dark as it was, as small as it was a refuge for me from physical torture. But over time, the cell in itself became a torture, psychological torture on its own. Just to give you an idea about how desperate I was to get out of that cell, I was ready to confess to anything. If they just, you know, take me out of that place. It was so horrible. And that's why I've always called it the Grave, because it's really like a grave. You're put in there. It's dark. You don't know anything about the outside world. It's so small. It's filthy. At moments, I really say to myself, life is not worth anything anymore. And, I lost hope. And it took 10 months and 10 days before I was taken out from that cell. I was in very, very bad shape.
The only times, I guess, you were taken out was to be tortured. So when... go ahead.
The main interrogation happened during the first, I would say, 10 days to 2 weeks. That's where the physical torture took place. Eventually, they took me upstairs a couple of months later to ask me one or two or three questions. But really, the main interrogation and the harshest sessions were at the beginning. That's where they used the physical torture.
What did they want to know?
Well, it was so obvious that the Syrians wanted to know more information about, you know, my life in Canada, my life in the States. Remember that I spent a year and a half or about almost 2 years working for a Boston firm. And so obviously, their main questions centered about my life, you know, my travels, the people I knew, what kind of work I was doing, you know. But I could tell after a two-week period, they never told it to me directly, but I could see in the eyes of the Syrian interrogators that I was not the person that I was described to them by the Americans. You have to remember, the Americans dumped me in Syria or in Jordan, then eventually I was taken to Syria, accusing me of being a member of Al-Qaeda. And so the Syrians had to do the dirty work and beat me. And, even though you confess to false things, the Syrians know it's false, and at the end of the day, what they're looking for is information, sound information. And I think really after, you know, 2 week period, they convinced themselves that there was nothing there.
Meher Arar will be back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Meher Arar. He was a victim of the secret American program known as Extraordinary Rendition. This allows for terrorism suspects to be deported to countries where they can be imprisoned, interrogated, and tortured. Arar was on a stopover at JFK on his way home to Canada when he was detained by American authorities and later deported to Syria, where he was beaten, interrogated, and imprisoned. After his return to Canada, a Canadian commission cleared him of all allegations of terrorism. Torture or extreme interrogation techniques have become so controversial in the United States, and everybody has been asking, well, do they work? You know, do these techniques actually get usable information? Give us your experience of that. Tell us a little bit about what was done in terms of torturing you and what that got you to say.
Well, I think human beings have this, any human being has this tendency to be able to resist to pressure, but frankly, any human being, as strong as he is or she is, they will just give up at the end, and that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to resist the beatings, but the Syrians eventually... After the first day and then of interrogation, they realized I had nothing. And the next day, they wanted me to say that I had been to Afghanistan. After many sessions of beatings and being left in a room to hear other people being tortured, I told them what they wanted to hear.
But you told them you were in Afghanistan, that you'd been in
that's
Afghanistan?
That's right, that's right.
Did you tell them? They wanted to hear that you were a member of Al-Qaeda. Did you tell them that?
I don't remember being asked about directly that question. You know, you have to remember that what I'm telling you is only a portion of what I remember. Believe me, you go in those sessions, it's like survival mode. You just want to, you know, survive. Do you remember every question they asked you? Do you remember every accusation they told you during that session? No. And... I only remember bits and pieces from some of those sessions. You know, the most striking thing that I remember was about Afghanistan, because that's where they focused and the most extreme beating happened, you know.
Could you give us an idea of what went on in your mind and the kind of bargains you made with yourself about how far you'd be capable of holding out before just telling them whatever they wanted to hear?
Well, you resist. But you see, the first day they didn't accuse me of anything. They were just gathering information. The beating happened next day. The head of the interrogation team opens the door. I was just, you know, in that room alone, without much, you know, uttering a word. He asked me to stand up and to open my right palm, and he hits me with a cable. And you know, it's very hard to describe that feeling, that pain. But to give you an idea about how extreme this pain was, I've always used this proverb in Arabic that basically says the pain that results out of the beatings is beyond imagination, to the point that where you will forget the milk that you have been fed from your mother. So basically, it's so intense to the point where you just beg them to stop. And obviously, at the beginning, you know, you say, I'm not going to say what they want to hear. But eventually, you're ready to do anything. You know, whatever they put in front of you, you'll just sign it.
Okay, so you comply with them finally. You tell lies just in the hopes that the torture will stop, and in the hopes that they'll send you home. So you tell them what they want to hear, and then what? Does the torture stop? Do they send you home?
Well, in my case, the torture did not completely stop, but it became a lot less intense. So if I remember correctly, from that moment on, they did not use the cable with me, or if they did, it was occasional. They mostly beat me with their fists, with their punch me, you know, slap me on the face, and beat me on the back of my neck. They also played mind games with me by taking me into a room blindfolded against the wall, and a lot of people would be talking about me, and you know, out of nowhere, someone would jump and beat me on the back of my head. So I would say after that, you know, it became less intense. They wanted to know my relationships with other people they were interested in, and you know, and what I did for a living and all of that. But after that false confession, they were, you know, the beatings became less severe.
Did you feel that you told them anything that could be used against people who you knew? Do you think anything you told them could be misconstrued and be used against family or friends, colleagues?
I don't remember, and I don't think so. But again, see, they're not like normal sessions where the FBI is sitting around the table and asking questions and maybe recording this and allowing your lawyer to record what you say and what you don't say. There are sessions where beating is the norm and fear is the norm. What do you say or you don't say, and what they write or did, it's not. But I can tell you, I don't think I have said things that would implicate people in anything. Basically, I could tell that, like, they were looking for something that the Americans did not find. I mean, that was a strong feeling in me. I mean, I could tell in their eyes, in their, like... And once that false confession took place, they were extremely happy with it. And, you know, so they just wanted to prove that they're better interrogators maybe than the Americans.
So after you'd be in an interrogation session and beaten and badly wounded by that, then you'd be put into this tomb-like underground cell that was basically like a little bigger than your body. How do you recover from wounds like that in a filthy tomb-like cell?
Well, let me tell you something that it's very hard for people, and you have to remember there are people who were tortured more than I was. And believe me, sometimes when I heard their stories later at a different prison they sent me to, I mean, I couldn't believe they were still living, you know. I think faith played a big role in this. you know, I'm a believer, and believing God helps you go through tough times. And now, actually, if you ask me how I survived those days, I can't tell you. I really don't know. Again, as I say, the human beings have this ability to adapt, and does not mean it was easy for me, but the pain, some of the pain, I could tell you, lasted for about 6 months. And up until today, I think back and I say, my God, how I was able to survive all of this.
What about mentally? How do you mentally survive in a tomb-like cell for 10 months?
The mental pain, I could tell you, was the most severe. Because, you see, the physical pain, even though some of the pain lasted for a while, but, you know, it's intense at 1 day or 2 days, 3 days, and eventually get the pain to go away within a month or two or three or four. But I could tell you that the mental pain and the psychological pain live with me until this day, and that I've been struggling with it and for since I came back. It was at its peak during that 10-month period. And believe me, at the end, I couldn't take it anymore. I'll just give you an example. Being locked up in this cell in, on itself, it's a type of torture. But also being incommunicado, like you don't know what's happening to your family, to your kids, you start thinking all kind of things, you know. Are they also doing well? Have they been kidnapped like you? What are my kids doing? How are they doing? Are they eating well? What is my wife doing? You know, that alone is... And remember, you're being put in there 24 hours a day, except the few minutes they take you out to the bathroom. I mean, that alone is mentally demanding. And that's why I call this time a slow death process, basically. You're basically dying. You know, at the beginning, I was able, you know, to do some push-ups so that I could keep in a good physical health. But after a few months, you know, I started with 20 push-ups, then 10 push-ups, then 5 push-ups. Then eventually I wasn't able to do any push-ups at all. And I don't know, if they kept me more in that cell, I would probably be dead by now.
My guest is Meher Arar. We'll talk more about his case, and we'll hear from his U.S. lawyer, Maria LaHood, after a break. This is Fresh Air.